of Mind with Catherine Davis. But right now, it's 10 a.m. on a Friday morning. Coming up next is On the Ground, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital with Esther Ivarim.
From Washington, D.C., this is On the Ground. As the Trump administration attacks the gains of the 1960s Black Freedom Movement, which addressed centuries of racist apartheid and greatly benefited all of U.S. society, we interview Gerald Horn about his new book on that era of revolutionary change.
It's not enough to be courageous. It's not enough to be bold. You need an analysis. And if you don't have an analysis, you're basically flying blind. And if you're flying blind, it seems to me it's inevitable that you'll crash.
We also discuss his book, African Americans and a New History of the USA.
What's remarkable is that until recently, believe it or not, the U.S. left, those who consider themselves to be radical, have not had in their ideological arsenal the concept of settler colonialism. I mean, it's really astonishing in retrospect.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital. I'm Esther Ivarim. First, our headlines. A Federal Aviation Administration report on Wednesday's collision of an American Airlines commercial flight and a military helicopter revealed that the air traffic control tower was not staffed at quote-unquote normal levels, with just one controller handling the work of two people during busy hours. 67 people are presumed dead in the crash, which occurred on the approach to D.C.'s National Airport. The FAA report was released Thursday, shortly after President Trump made statements on social media and then in a press conference blaming without evidence programs of diversity, equity, and inclusion for the crash. Critics of Trump's rhetoric hit back, pointing out that since inauguration, Trump has taken several steps that could make air travel more dangerous for Americans, including firing top air safety officials, gutting the Federal Aviation Security Advisory Committee, including air traffic controllers and federal buyout notices, and giving them 1 week to decide, and imposing a federal hiring freeze when more air traffic controllers are needed. The deadly plane crash and Trump's biased remarks mark a tragic end to his first 10 days in office, which he had touted the best start to any administration in U.S. history. In just the first week alone, he declared an emergency at the Mexico border, launched immigration raids that have also ensnared U.S. citizens, dismantled federal civil rights protections, attacked programs promoting diversity, equity, and inclusion, attacked the public sector workforce, released violent January 6 insurrectionists, and tried to repeal birthright citizenship. Speaking 7 days into his presidency at a Republican retreat at his Doral resort in Miami, he said his goal is to destroy the movements that have fought for workers' rights for the past century.
Together, we're forging a new political majority that's shattering and replacing Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal coalition, which dominated American politics for over 100 years. That's what we're doing.
In his speech, Trump also boasted about his freeze on foreign aid, withdrawing the United States from the Paris Climate Accord and sending U.S. troops to the U.S.-Mexico border. He also joked about whether he could run for a third term, which would be prohibited under the U.S. Constitution. But the Trump machine is not rolling on without roadblocks. His border czar, Tom Homan, admitted to CNN this week that some ICE raid efforts are being hampered because activists have educated immigrants about their rights to not open the door, for example, and to be able to identify a proper warrant from proper authorities. Also, We Fight Back 2025 organizing meetings are being held around the country, and rallies attended by hundreds in Texas this week have demonstrated support for immigrants with signs that read, quote, "No one is illegal on stolen land." Also, Impeach Trump Again, a nonpartisan campaign led by Free Speech for People, has garnered more than 100,000 petition signatures signaling support for an impeachment investigation of President Donald Trump's violations of the emoluments clauses, his pardoning and blocking the prosecution of January 6th insurrectionists, and, quote, "lawless and unconstitutional actions," end quote, since taking office. Unions representing federal employees are also fighting back against Trump administration actions focused on civil servants, including the January 28th memo sent from the U.S. Office of Personnel Management offering most of the federal workforce the option to resign or remain in their positions, but without, quote, "full assurance regarding the certainty of a worker's position or agency," end quote. Three unions have filed two separate lawsuits challenging Trump's Schedule F executive order, a measure aimed at removing job protections for many career federal employees. And a coalition of human rights organizations is planning to protest at the White House on Tuesday, February 4th at 6 p.m., the visit of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, the first foreign leader to receive an invitation from Trump, even though the International Criminal Court has issued an arrest warrant for Netanyahu for war crimes and crimes against humanity in Gaza. And finally, in culture and media, nonprofit news organizations are also on alert and fighting back threats to strip them of public funding and nonprofit status. On Thursday, President Trump's new head of the Federal Communications Commission, Brendan Carr, said he is ordering an investigation of NPR and PBS, both nonprofits, because he said they could be violating federal law by airing commercials. The organization Our Revolution is mounting a campaign to support both networks and sent out an email Thursday that stated, quote, "Trump and his billionaire backers have declared an all-out war on truth. They're coming after our independent media, eager to get it out of the way so they can easily spread disinformation and rake in billions by sending us to the platforms they own to get our news," end quote. For the Pacifica Network, the organization Pacifica Fight Back at PacificaFightBack.org is galvanizing show producers and all volunteers to support the oldest listener-supported radio network in the country. And those are headlines and happenings. Stay with us.
I go on and on, can't understand how I last so long. I must have superpowers, rap 225,000 hours. Get a calculator, do the math. I made 1,000 songs that made you move, yeah. And for the last 300 months, I made 16 albums with me on the front, and they bump. Where you get your beats? I heard 93 rappers say like me. Two singers and 10 comedians, and I'm still gonna yell it every time you see me in. What's my favorite word? Why they gotta say it like short? You know they can't play on my court. Can't hang with the big dogs, stay on the porch. Blow the whistle. IMP, Bun B, that's Texas, baby. Ballin' G, that's Memphis, baby. Short dog,
This is On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, voices of resistance from the nation's capital. I'm Esther Ivarum. Now I'm joined by our geopolitical analyst, Gerald Horn, the Morris Professor of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. And we're going to talk about his two most recent books, Armed Struggle, Panthers and Communists, Black Nationalists and Liberals in Southern California Through the 60s and 70s, and another new book, African Americans, A New History of the USA. Welcome back to the show, Gerald.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, I thought I would start with this, you know, more familiar histories of the U.S. Black freedom movement, such as Eyes on the Prize documentary series or the Parting the Waters books by Taylor Branch about America in the King years, focus rightly on the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., the SCLC, and the best of those histories don't spare details about the extreme violence that the shock troops of that revolution faced in the South and even in parts of the North, right? But it seems like in your book, you shift to what, you know, to a layman like me, it seems like the next act of that Black freedom movement in Southern California, when the Black Panthers emerged and the emphasis was often on the willingness to take up arms, right? And they also faced extreme violence in that part of the country from the LAPD, the Los Angeles Police Department, and other elements of the state. So I just thought that maybe we could start with you connecting the dots for us and how this history that you detail in such a very rich way connects to the more familiar history that most of us know about the beginnings of the Black freedom movement in the South, and maybe why you focus on the idea of armed struggle, which is like a question mark in your title.
Well, the book begins, as you know, with a Panther delegation in Algiers, North Africa, meeting with envoys from then socialist Czechoslovakia, which had a thriving arms industry. And the idea was for the Czechs and the Slovaks to provide weapons to the Panthers for their struggle in the United States of America. In that same paragraph, I also talk about how the legation of the Vietnamese similarly provide arms to the Panthers. This is reflection of the unremitting violence exerted against Black people in California in particular, although you would be correct to infer that that kind of violence was endemic from the Atlantic to the Pacific. And it also ties in to the other book, that is to say, African Americans in a New History of the United States of America, which traces our serpentine course in North America from the shores of Africa, across the Middle Passage, through slavery, etc. And one of the central points that I posit there is that the settler colonialism into which Black people were thrust was based upon class collaboration amongst the European settlers, whereas the enslaved had no alternative but to engage in class struggle. And this contradiction between class struggle and class collaboration persists to this very day and manifested itself most recently, I dare say, on November 5th, 2024. A problem has been coming to that kind of realization. And in order to launch armed struggle, obviously, you need an analysis of the forces on the ground, not only domestically, but globally. But if you accept the liberal interpretation of the history of the United States, inevitably, you'll tend to underestimate the retrograde forces, the forces of reaction. It won't lead you to an adept, a penetrating analysis that would allow you to make a decision so portentous as to launch armed struggle. So there is an intersection between these two books that I hope to elaborate upon in more detail on Saturday, February 1st, 6 to 8 at Sankofa Bookstore.
There are two things that you mentioned that I was going to kind of maybe ask you later, but maybe this is a good place to kind of interject. So, I guess you kind of answered the question already. So, okay, by raising the issue of armed struggle and knowing in hindsight that the Panthers were not successful in mounting, or not that they even got to the point of mounting an armed struggle, but considering it, how do we frame their at least their willingness to oppose what had been a long history of violence against us? Do we just dismiss it as premature or foolish and easily crushed? And, you know, if we look at it that way, then how do we put that in a place so that people aren't discouraged and that people aren't discouraged and feel defeated, you know, as we face some of these same forces or even more virulent forces today?
Well, as my previous comment suggested, I began the story in North Africa, mm-hmm. and that was intentional. I think that with regard to launching armed struggle, if it is to occur again in the 21st century, for example, one of the lessons to draw from my book is that one not only needs an analysis of the domestic situation, one needs an analysis of the global situation. And one of the flaws of the Panthers' approach, at least some of the Panthers, certainly not all, was their rather difficult relationship with the government in Havana, Cuba. And it seems to me that is a lesson that must be learned if there are any so bold as to try to take that approach again. So it's not as if I'm saying even that it was premature. Mm-hmm. It's not that I'm saying that it was foolish. I'm saying that if this is what you're going to do, then there are certain ducks you must have in a row. Right. And one of the key ducks is international allies, for example, particularly given the fact that the domestic correlation of forces is so adverse, given settler colonialism. So that is a central lesson of this story that I tell in the Armed Struggle book.
By mentioning November 5th, 2024, you also brought up another discussion point I wanted to raise. So we're coming out of a week where there's been a concerted effort by the Trump administration to try to reverse or attempt to reverse many of the gains that were won during this era of the Black Freedom Movement. And so given the fact that many of us relate those gains to the nonviolent movement that occurred through Martin Luther King Jr. and the organizing in the American South, how do you place the emphasis that was a little different on the West Coast, I guess not only in Southern California, but in the Bay Area through the Panthers, that was focused in a different way? I'm thinking about the breakfast programs, again, the willingness to talk about arms. And, you know, I remember the action when the Panthers went to Sacramento armed. So it was just a more militant phase. So I'm thinking now in terms of seeing so many of these gains that have been under attack for the past 40 to 50 years, for sure, almost as soon as they were enacted, right? But the look at what you think about the reforms, which can be reversed or attempt to be reversed, or versus the more permanent gains that you make if you are able to engage in armed struggle.
Well, first of all, this book, as you know, not only deals with the Panthers, it deals with the preceding epic being the Red Scare and anti-communism. And I think part of the problem with many of the volumes dealing with the Black Freedom Movement and the gains is that they lied that whole period. They act like it's irrelevant that a giant like Paul Robeson is marginalized at the same time that civil rights concessions are flowing, when actually they're intimately connected. As not only, I argue, in this book, but in other books as well. Not only that, but the movement in the South was propelled once again by changed international correlation of forces. That is to say, with the rise of a socialist camp and national liberation movements in Africa and the Caribbean in particular, U.S. imperialism found it difficult to win hearts and minds in the struggle with socialism as long as Black people were treated so atrociously. So that creates a dynamic whereby there are civil rights concessions. The price of the ticket is high, which is tossing overboard the internationalists amongst us, Paul Robeson in the first instance, but there are thousands who are marching alongside him. And that ill disposes this movement to make tactical and strategic objectives. Once the international situation changes, which it, of course it does, in 1991 with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the retreat of a number of its allies in Africa and the Caribbean, leaving us with this present difficult moment. Likewise, the struggle in California cannot be separated once again from that changed international correlation of forces. One of the eras, in addition to their difficult relations with Cuba, one of the eras that the Panthers made was that they were all in with regard to Maoism, with regard to this split in the socialist camp, which U.S. imperialism under Nixon helped to exacerbate, that is to say, winning China over to an anti-Soviet position, which then weakens the Soviet Union, leading to its collapse in 1991. But as Nixon said before he passed away, the deal that U.S. imperialism made with China might have created this Frankenstein monster. That's his phrase, not mine. And what we now see, and it's, I find it staggering and astonishing that more of our friends on the left, or even liberals, don't see the connection, the connections that I'm now drawing between the rise of China, the collapse of the Soviet Union. I mean, if I can make a footnote with regard to this hysteria about artificial intelligence and deep sea,
right,
trillions of dollars in stock value lost. And so with regard to Black people in particular, it's not enough to be courageous. It's not enough to be bold. You need an analysis. And if you don't have an analysis, you're basically flying blind. And if you're flying blind, it seems to me it's inevitable that you'll crash.
I have a footnote for myself also, because I have a note to ask you whether this is like your 60s book, because so many the other histories, as you just mentioned, follow, even if they're very powerful, like, you know, I remember reading the Taylor Branch books. I mean, they're very powerful for what they do deliver. You widen the aperture to look before the 60s and well before the 60s. Like, for example, I was shocked to learn that in Southern California, not only were Black people enslaved, but the indigenous were enslaved, and even Chinese people. So I'm sure that that's one fact of many that, that people get from this book that they haven't previously known. But also, it reinforced for me, I don't know if I knew this before and I just forgot, but I have been very, very often, and probably in a lazy way, calling that era the Black Power Movement. And then I remembered that, okay, no, that's different from saying the Black Freedom Movement, which is kind of all encompassing, because you make the point that at that time, the Black Power Movement was considered the more the cultural nationalist strain that was more closely related to the Black culture movement of the time.
Well, one of the points that I make is that in some ways, some of our historians have confused the issues, as your comment tends to suggest. I happen to have been around for a good deal of this period that I'm writing about. And as I write in the book, many of the Panthers, they drew a distinction between what they were trying to accomplish and what they thought that the so-called Black Power advocates were seeking to accomplish. But the historians and those that follow them have collapsed those distinctions
Right.
Of putting in the same rubric people who were at each other's throats at the time. For example, the so-called cultural nationalists who bequeathed to us Kwanzaa, led by Malana Karenga of Los Angeles, and the Black Panthers. I mentioned it in the book that many of the Black Panthers were deeply influenced, as my previous comments suggest, by the worldwide socialist movement. They were deeply influenced by African liberation movements, Frelimo in Mozambique, MPLA in Angola, which were deeply influenced by the socialist tradition. I myself met Marcelino dos Santos, a founder of Frelimo, at a conference in Moscow some decades ago. Jonathan Jackson, the younger brother of George Jackson, the celebrated political prisoner, as a precocious high school student in Pasadena, California, had a newsletter entitled Iskra, homage to a publication of the same name coming from the Bolsheviks in Russia. I recall, while living in Berkeley in the Bay Area during the heyday of the Panthers, that in our study groups, we were reading George Plekhanov, for example, a Bolshevik theoretician, who, of course, has now sort of disappeared into the mist of history. And unfortunately, the historians and the histories, they don't give you that sort of detail. I think it's because, of course, you know, the Soviet Union collapsed, it's an anti-communist country, there was a Red Scare, and I guess they feel it would be discrediting to talk about all these sorts of connections with Bolsheviks and Russian communists, even communists in Africa, for example, the South African Communist Party, which, of course, now holds ministerial portfolios in Pretoria. But I don't know. I mean, I don't think that a disadvantaged and oppressed and persecuted community like Black people are in North America can afford to elide these sorts of historical details in order possibly to curry favor with these real or imaginary, most likely the latter, liberal allies.
Mm-hmm. There's one more point about that, and I want to mention this before I go to a little break. So I think part of the confusion is that emerging, and I don't think was necessarily connected with the kind of the cultural piece with like Malana Karenga necessarily, but see here on the East Coast, the emergence of a really powerful Black arts movement is often, maybe it's also lumped into this whole era as a whole, right? And a leader in that Black arts movement was Amiri Baraka, for example. And my understanding of him is more related to embracing socialism as opposed to, you know, a development of something like Kwanzaa, right? So I know we could probably go into a lot of detail that we don't have time for, but can you address that for those of us who may feel that, okay, Baraka at least is an outlier, because the Black arts movement was very powerful. And it was, I think, a way that the masses of Black people connected to the struggle, even if they weren't a member of the Panthers. And they relate the Panthers to the idea of the Black arts movement because of, you know, maybe the newspaper. I think song was a part of the struggle. They would sing, you know, revolution has come, you know. And so, I don't know. Can you parse that for me?
So, needless to say, I respect Amiri Baraka, the former Leroy Jones, immensely. And as you probably know, he ultimately broke ranks with his erstwhile comrades in the cultural nationalist movement, some of whom were tied to the Black arts movement, Mr. Karenga in particular, and moved towards a socialist orientation where he was sitting at the time of his death a few years ago. Mm-hmm. History is an ongoing process, and history is an ongoing process because new sources are oftentimes emerging that allow us to alter our interpretations, not to mention, as I suggested, in terms of what I consider to be misinterpretations of the so-called Black Power phase, interpretations change. For example, I'll be at the library of George Washington University going through the archive of Richard Gibson, once a notorious Black agent of U.S. intelligence, although he denied it for a number of years and it was inadvertently revealed. And he has enormous correspondence with Baraka. Now, when I go through the correspondence, amongst my tasks will be to say or to ascertain if this correspondence pertains to Mr. Baraka's cultural nationalist phase, which probably it does, or whether it pertains to Maoism, which probably it does. And once I finish my research, then I'll be able to make another interpretation of Baraka, another interpretation of the Black Power movement. And that's the way history proceeds. That is to say, new archives emerge, new interpretations emerge, and hopefully new insight emerges.
Okay. So my history that comes a little after yours, when I was in college in the 80s, and I was in a group that invited Baraka to speak at University of Southern California, he was definitely more, I believe, into the phase of embracing socialism and moving away from the earlier emphasis he had. Mm-hmm. So that's why I arrived at that particular question. But I see that I need to take a brief break. This is On the Ground. We'll be right back. I don't want to take no time to write this down. I don't want to say how I feel right now. Yeah, yeah. Tomorrow may never come. But for you or me, life is not promised. Tomorrow may never show up. For you or me, life is not promised. Yeah. I ain't no perfect man. I'm shining to the best that I can with what it is I have. And I ain't no perfect man. I'm shining to the best that I can with this mic in my hand. Even though it's feedback still won't come at you, put my heart and soul into it, y'all. Let's start. Do you feel me?
Shine your light on the world. Shine it. Shine your light.
This is On the Ground. I'm Esther Avaram, and I'm in conversation with our geopolitical analyst, Gerald Horn, about his two latest books, Armed Struggle, Panthers and Communists, Black Nationalists and Liberals in Southern California through the 60s and 70s, and a second new book, African Americans and a New History of the USA. So now, for the time that we have left, I want to go into the history part, because I think that for many people, what the history that you provide here will be like new information, not only because of the your willingness to go to, again, widen the aperture, to go beyond just this kind of laser focus on the Panthers and that era, but to go back in history. I think I already mentioned that, you know, a lot of people don't really know about the early history of violent settler colonialism in Southern California and how that relates to the quote unquote Wild West nature of Southern California and the violence there, but also the racism practiced there that, you know, a lot of people don't really recognize because they think of California as this kind of liberal paradise that people were escaping to, going from the Black Belt Southwest to kind of escape that. So you say in the book that a lot of what happened with the Panthers in the 60s was connected to, quote, the proximity to Mexico, proliferation of colleges, serpentine highways, freeways, brutal cops, and an empowered ultra-right, end quote. And that these elements really serve to propel both the Communist Party and the Black Panther Party. So I want you to talk a little bit about that, but I want to make a note that, especially for my listeners in D.C., that you do mention Dorothy Healy, who was a show programmer for so long on WPFW Pacifica Radio. And because you are connecting these histories between, and you're willing to address the history and include the history of communists in Southern California, where other histories kind of like don't touch it, right? You mentioned a lot of the people who might otherwise just kind of be lost to history, or they won't be connected to how the fight back by socialists and communists in Southern California helped to give rise to the Black Panther Party and how the two parties were intermingled.
Well, certainly, and a bridge between the two, of course, was Professor Angela Davis, still in the land of the living, fortunately, who emerged in the Southland in Southern California and was eventually put on trial because of allegations that she was implicated in the attempt by the aforementioned Jonathan Jackson to help to free his older brother, George Jackson, that led to a global movement. As suggested, Professor Davis had connections to both the Panthers and the Communists, and the latter used their international connections to help to build a global movement that catapulted her into the global spotlight, attracting forces, including Aretha Franklin and Toni Morrison, subsequent Nobel laureate, and others too numerous to mention. Also part of the story is the NAACP, the largest mass organization today, even still, amongst Black Americans. And it found it necessary to embark on an anti-communist path in terms of embracing anti-communism. One of its West Coast leaders, Franklin Williams, eventually gets a kind of payoff when he becomes U.S. ambassador to Ghana under Kwame Nkrumah. He is on the scene of 1966 when Kwame Nkrumah is overthrown with a coup. He denies being implicated in that devilish act. Others are not as certain. And given the fact that this is Southern California, we're also dealing with the entertainment industry. And both the Communists and the Panthers, one of the reasons why they were able to build programs, you mentioned the free breakfast program of the Panthers, for example, not to mention other programs involving organized labor that the Communist Party helped to spark, some of which is dealt with in previous books that I've written, with regard to organizing in the film industry. You might know my book, Class Struggle in Hollywood. You might know my book, a biography of John Howard Lawson, who was the leader of the Communist Party in Hollywood and wrote a number of popular screenplays, including Sahara, A Blockade, the screenplay involving South Africa, one of the first anti-apartheid dramas starring Canada Lee and Sidney Poitier. And their popularity, their income helped to propel initially the communist movement, which then was placed on trial after many of their leaders had attained thousands of votes in competitive elections. But then they were placed on trial, were basically deep sixed, many of them driven into exile, such as Dalton Trumbo, perhaps the most talented screenwriter Hollywood has produced at this point. You might be familiar with the screenplay that he did, The Spartacus, starring Kirk Douglas, based on the Howard Fast novel. He was forced into exile in Mexico for a while, for example. And that disrupted, obviously, the communist movement in this country, but it did have lingering effect, particularly in the 1970s, when Professor Davis was put on trial.
When you started to talk about that, I think you were talking about the reason why they were able to have these programs is because they had support from maybe people with money in Hollywood. You know, they had support and just other prominent people. And I thought, I was just questioning was if that was the point you were making, or was it the fact that Davis was the subject of anti-communism, or both?
Professor Davis certainly was subjected to anti-communism, to be sure. And also, to be sure, the Panthers and the communists had influence in Hollywood. We should never forget the immense contributions made by Jane Fonda, for example, during this period, which led to a downturn at a certain point in her career. But she was quite important in terms of raising consciousness, raising funds, et cetera.
Right.
So yes, you know, they had support amongst Hollywood, and yes, they were persecuted as a direct result.
Right. Okay. So I want us to talk about the other new book, African Americans and a New History of the USA. And I think that maybe one bridge is to follow up on your discussion about writing about history and reporting on history being kind of an evolving process, because you get new documents, you get new insights, more information is brought forward. You know, talk about how, you know, maybe even what you wrote in Armed Struggle connects to that. And especially now, when, as I think I mentioned earlier, when so many of the gains that were won during that period are either being reversed, they've been attempted to be reversed, and the fact that the Black freedom movement in the 60s didn't only benefit Black people, it changed this whole society for women, for the disabled, for the elderly, for the poor, for immigrants. Even with the 1965, I believe, whether it was called the Immigration Act or whatever it was, so many of the people who have been able to come into the country, you know, this act that changed the kind of racist immigration policies. And so now we see, you know, the Trump administration with his shock and awe, you know, first 10 days or whatever, trying to reverse all that. It's a direct response to this powerful Black freedom movement 40 to 50 years ago. Or I guess some people would say, you know, really starting in the 50s. So we might be up to 70 years ago. But anyway, go ahead.
Well, I think that the speed and velocity with which these gains have been dismantled or are in the process of being dismantled should lead one to the reasonable inference that they were built on a foundation of sand. That is to say, as I've suggested a moment or two ago, that when you talk about the Black freedom movement, you must also talk about the preceding epoch, meaning the Red Scare, whereby mass organizations, particularly of the left, were systematically persecuted and dismantled. And then NAACP went along with the Faustian bargain of working in concert with the liberal wing of the U.S. ruling elite, then embodied by Earl Warren, Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, which then authors these opinions that helped to pave the way for these gains. But alas, Earl Warren was a very unstable ally. Recall that in the preceding decade of the 1940s, he was an architect of the internment of Japanese Americans when he was governor of California. And in any case, he came under withering fire in the 1950s and the 1960s by the right wing because of these Supreme Court decisions inaugurated by Brown versus Board of Education invalidating Jim Crow in 1954, which then leads to a mass uprising of what might today be called the Trump base in Little Rock, Arkansas, 1957, in Jackson, Mississippi, 1962, in Boston with the busing crisis of the 1970s, in Yonkers, New York, with the housing crisis of the 1980s. And what's remarkable to now build a bridge to the book African Americans and the New History of the United States of America is that until recently, believe it or not, the U.S. left, those who consider themselves to be radical, have not had in their ideological arsenal the concept of settler colonialism. I mean, it's really astonishing in retrospect. I mean, because after all, we know, any school child can tell you that at a certain point, you had an invasion of North America by these Europeans who united across class lines to loot and plunder the indigenous and then to enslave the Africans and engage in what could only be called class collaboration, a phrase also conspicuously missing from the ordinary vocabulary of many of our friends on the left. And indeed, with regard to our friends on the left, of course, we're about to enter this phase where there's this flood of national chauvinism as we march towards July 4th, 2026, and the 250th anniversary of the founding of the United States of America. And some of the staunchest opponents of new visions of the United States are precisely our friends on the left, which is very interesting because what it reveals inadvertently is that the United States, even those who consider themselves to be revolutionary, they rebuke those of us who have a critique of 1776, leaving the inference that there was nothing wrong with 1776, which means that there should not necessarily be a revolution in the 21st century, even though they say there should be. I mean, it's as convoluted ideological course as one can imagine. So this is what I'm trying to unravel in the new history book. And also religion plays a major role in this book because, as I posited, you've had a transition from religion as a major marker of society from the founding of Christianity 2,000 years ago to the rise of Islam approximately 1,400 years ago to the conflict between the two, the expulsion of the Jewish community from mostly Christian England about 700 to 800 years ago, the conflict between Protestants and Catholics, which marks the rise of capitalism in the 1500s, with Protestant England stealing a march on Catholic Spain by broadening the base of support for their colonial project, by virtually inventing this new concept of whiteness, whereby those they had been warring with in the British Isles, particularly the Irish and the Scots, once they crossed the Atlantic, rather magically, they adopt this new identity called whiteness, and then that identity is expanded to include those that they had been warring, German versus Pole, Pole versus Russian, Serb versus Croat, Northern Italian versus Southern Italian, even Lebanese Christians, Egyptian Christians. So they're all magically rebranded as white, which is the winning ticket, which then manifests itself today when you see these conflicts, as we've seen in the past week, between the United States of America and the former Spanish colonies, particularly Colombia, where you have this tiff between President Petro and President Trump, not to mention the former Portuguese colony that is Brazil, also still, to a certain degree, influenced by Catholicism. Certainly, the Catholics were essential to their colonizing. So these latter points are what are addressed in the second book. But once again, the two books can be read profitably together, particularly with regard to our friends, including the Panthers and the Communists, not being able to necessarily comprehend what they were up against, which then leads to inadequate estimates, which can lead to disaster.
So we're out of time, and but I do want to ask you, you make a comment in Armed Struggle that some of that history you also track in your book about Washington, D.C., which we discussed. And I just wanted to know if you wanted to expound on that a little bit.
Well, you had some of the same ideological forces in the District of Columbia. You had communist forces. You had black nationalist forces, for example. Washington, D.C. historically has had a strong NAACP chapter. It went along with the national office in terms of purging of folks on the left, for example, like the NAACP chapter in the Southland of Southern California did. So, yes, there is a parallel between the studies of Washington and the studies of Southern California.
All right. So finally, do you want to tell us about your event here in Washington?
So I'll be speaking at Sankofa Bookstore in Washington, D.C., across the street from Howard University on Georgia Avenue on Saturday, February 1st from 6 to 8, discussing many of the themes that I have just referenced with regard to the Panthers, the communists, ideological struggle, and most important of all, where do we go from here?
Okay. Well, I've been speaking to our geopolitical analyst, Gerald Horn, professor of history and African-American studies at the University of Houston, and the author of these two new books. Thank you so much for joining me today, Gerald, to really take a deep dive into your latest works.
Thank you for inviting me.
And our geopolitical analyst, Professor Gerald Horn, will have the last word on today's show. This is On the Ground, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital, on more than two dozen stations on the Pacifica Radio Network. We're on all your podcast platforms, including Spotify, Stitcher, and Apple, at On the Ground with Esther Evarim. And we archive all of our shows on our website, onthegroundshow.org, where you can also contact us. You can reach us at X, Twitter, Facebook, and Patreon.com at On the Ground Show. I also link to every show on my Instagram page, which is Esther_Evarim, ESTHER_I, V like Victor, ER, EM like Mary. The music we played this hour included Blow the Whistle by Too Short, Umi Says by Yasin Bey, and our theme music is Voodoo Child by Jimi Hendrix. I'm Esther Evarim. Until next time, take good care and keep raising your voice. Peace.
back to you on one of these days. I didn't mean to take up all your sweet time.
You asked me to come here.
I want you to help me write my will.
How may I help?
Well, how does it begin?
I believe you state your name and that you are of sound mind.
Do I have to prove that?
No, just say so.
And then what?
You say how you want your estate divided.
I don't have an estate.
A living person does not have an estate, but there is estate planning.
You mean for when I will have an estate?
When you are no longer a living person.
Like before I was born.
Yes, but before you were born, you didn't have a name.
And I wasn't of sound mind.
Any other questions?
Who should I leave my money to?
Your spouse, children, brothers and sisters, nieces and nephews, grandchildren, favorite charities.
Ooh, like a radio station?
A listener-sponsored radio station.
Good. I want to leave the bulk of my estate to radio station WBAI. What do I care? I'll be dead anyway.
Right.
WBAI accepts snowmobiles. If you have a snowmobile, we want it. We also want any extra cars, trucks, SUVs, RVs, boats, and more. Any reason is a good reason to give a vehicle to WBAI. Some do it to avoid the hassles of selling. Some like to skip the costs of repairing, while others just enjoy the good feelings of giving back to their community. But no matter your reason, donating a vehicle to WBAI is a great idea. And it's easy. Here's how it works. Simply call 866-WBAI-CAR. That's 866-922-4227. Or give online at WBAI.org/donate-your-car. Our vehicle donor support team will arrange your free pickup. When the driver arrives to tow away your great gift, you'll receive a donation receipt. Vehicle donations have the potential to drive hundreds and sometimes even thousands of dollars to WBAI. Call 866-WBAI-CAR or visit WBAI.org/donate-your-car.
Listening to non-commercial radio in New York. WBAI is the place to turn to. Peace.
Oh my God. Hear my mother got a sleeping suicide singing. Oh my God. Hear my mother got a sleeping genocide singing. Oh my God. Hear my mother got a sleeping suicide singing. Oh my God.
This is Charles Barron, the co-host, along with Inez Barron of Speaking Truth to Power. From 5 to 6 p.m. every Friday on WBAI, we're going to bring grassroots people on to talk about the importance of putting people in office that are your loyal supporters, not sellouts, not those who are going to continue to push the capitalist system. Speaking Truth to Power, we're going to give you loads of information, documentation of the hypocrisy of the capitalist system and all of their political puppets. Come on now, Speaking Truth to Power. From 5 to 6 p.m. every Friday on WBAI 99.5 on your FM dial. And believe me, we're going to bring it. And we're going to bring it strong.